Thank you all for coming. This is a talk that I've given maybe half a dozen times now, and the bulk of it is headed towards a book, and a little bit at the tail end, maybe headed towards a different book that probably doesn't belong in the main one. Before I get into the slides, I was gonna tell a little story that this morning inspired in me. When Judy was talking about the difficulty of people having a vision of peace. And about 25 years ago, when I was very intensely concerned with the threat of nuclear exchange, nuclear war, I had a really powerful visionary experience that culminated in a vision where I was a very old man in a garden, surrounded by my children that were all of humanity. But it was a wild garden that was no longer wild because we were a humanity that had lost the fear of nature, and with it the fear of the feminine that was the same. And we had come home to a state where nature and humanity had come back together in a very high state. And that vision has very much been kind of the guiding star for everything that I'm going to talk about today. So everything that I'm going to present today is kind of the unfolding of 25 years of deepening and putting some detail on that vision. So what I'm really doing is telling a story, a very big story about time and about humanity and nature. And given where the world seems to be right now, it's also really an attempt to radically reframe two different stories, both of which I spend some time with. And these are kind of maybe the two of the prevailing mythos in the world right now. In one of them, the sort of headlong growth is a positive thing, the sort of ascent of man, progress, future, going infinitely, unifying the globe, capitalism, and basically I call this the market is God. And this narrative basically says that the market and technology will fix everything. And it's a strangely faith-based position. Even though we think about it as a really secular, rational position, it's actually exceedingly faith-based. It takes as an article of faith that there is this system that's larger than our intelligence that we sort of somehow create by accident that will fix it. Countervailing to that is the view that we probably are more identified with, that looks around at all of the indicators and sees just how fast the world is being trashed, and that those trends in many cases are still accelerating. And for anybody that isn't deeply familiar with them, I'm going to give you a little tour of some of them in a minute. And you know, sees the train wreck coming really fast and is probably most frightened because the market is God camp seems incapable of taking that view on board, where if they would actually respond to these forces, maybe their creativity and dynamism could deal with the situation. So this is the sort of basic idea behind that, that in all arguments, both sides are right in what they affirm and wrong in what they deny. So the first piece of this is simply going to go through at a very high level and just touch on a few milestones in biological evolution. And I'm picking out a few because they sort of help to make this long-term argument that I'm going to show. And with apologies to Elizabeth, they may not do them very well, but this is sort of a short list of them, and I'm going to go through them in order now. So when we emerged as life, we basically had some reserves. Whenever life figured out how to assemble itself out of the chemicals that were here on this planet, there were a lot of high-energy chemicals floating around that those early forms of life could consume. And so that went merrily on its way for quite a while. And as I understand it, we don't really know whether that ran out and put pressure on it or whether it was sort of a discovery that happened by itself, but photosynthesis came on scene very early. And at that point, life figured out how to consume sunlight, how to take the energy coming from our local star and use it to arrange carbon compounds and make more complex structures. And that has been the basis of life on this planet ever since. That's, with the exception of a little bit of nuclear energy, really where everything comes from. And so this went on for a very long time, consuming sunlight and throwing off oxygen. And the oxygen had to rust all of the iron available in the lithosphere. So the iron was brought up to the surface and rusted and then sucked back underground, and all of the rock, all of the mantle, had to be surfaced and rusted and surfaced and rusted until we finally finished rusting it all. And at that point, we had an oxygen crisis. We had an atmospheric crisis that makes the current CO2 crisis probably look tame in comparison. We weren't there, so we don't know exactly what happened, but it looks as if the oxygen levels in the atmosphere got high enough that things would have started spontaneously combusting. And they wouldn't have been trees and large structures like this. They would have been simpler organisms at that point. But it was a pretty grave situation, whereupon life figured out respiration. And respiration took advantage of this otherwise dangerous oxygen available in the atmosphere and figured out how to use it for energy. And so with that energy source, life could jump to a higher level of order. And so with both a second kind of photosynthesis and respiration in place, the carbon cycle resulted. And you could think in very simple terms of the carbon cycle as the balance between animals and plants, but it's really most of what we think of as animals are not larger animals. They're soil organisms and fungi and very small bacteria that are balancing with the photosynthesizing plants. But the point is that there's this very elegant balance in terms of the smallest, simplest chemicals possible, the simplest elements being traded back and forth in a very elegant loop. And once the basic chemistry of that was figured out once, all of the organisms that evolved since then have continued to use those same strategies. They just have used them in more and more complex forms. And that process has persisted up to today. And the amount that we're unbalancing it compared to the flows in nature is still very small. The amount of carbon that we contribute to the whole cycle is still a fraction of what's going on. It's just that if you add that up year in, year out for a while, it begins to accumulate. And it actually first started going out of balance as soon as we invented agriculture. About 10 or 12,000 years ago, we can see evidence of the atmosphere beginning to change and the CO2 level beginning to rise. And then with the advent of the Industrial Revolution and fossil fuels, much more was being pumped into it much faster, until we're now at a point where it's really accelerating rapidly and becoming very dangerous. So that's a very, very brief tour of, up to our point. But what I want to point out there is that there is precedent of both energy crisis and atmospheric crisis in the biological record on this planet. And if we think of ourselves not as something other than that, but another expression of that, it may change the way we look at the situation. So now I'm going to kind of take a little tour through the situation that we're facing. And I suspect many people in the room are already quite familiar with this, but for anybody who's not, it's useful to get everybody up to speed. So I have a list here of five really powerful crises, drivers, I think evolutionary drivers. They're certainly not necessarily in the order that I would put them here, but they may be fairly close to the order that most people might be thinking about right now here, where climate change has emerged at the top of the heap of what a lot of people are paying attention to. Peak oil is surfacing a lot of people's radar, even though it's probably quite a ways out in terms of really being a strong force. The thing that I would put at the top of the list is actually resource depletion, which a lot of people are almost completely unaware of. And population has kind of dropped out of the news, but it's still a huge wild card. And finally, the economic system that Bernard alluded to, and normally I'd spend more time on, but I actually think maybe the leverage point. So this is the graph of atmospheric CO2 and temperature over the last 1,000 years. That's taken from ice core data. The blue line is the ice core, the red line is temperature, and it's spanning about 1,000 years. And you can see it just spikes in the last 100. These are a couple of kind of geeky graphs. You can see that somebody put them up on the web from, you know, scanning their hard pen plot of about 150,000 years. And what's important to get at this is that the highest baseline that we're coming from, in that last graph we saw, that was the baseline, which is like this over here, and this is where it's been. And this is our current spike. And then this is methane, which is even more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. And when you see them in this kind of context, you do get a kind of visceral appreciation that we're not in the range where things have been. It doesn't, you know, if you just look at this, it's kind of hard to believe the Coal Council. So this is a graph of projected oil, and I think this includes natural gas. It doesn't include coal or oil sand or other sources of hydrocarbons, but this is oil and gas, and you can see on the time scale, you are here. And that's actually the natural gas, this is the oil. But the point is that we are at the climax of the oil age. We're running out of oil from here on out, even if we had atmosphere to dump it in. And we're actually running out of atmosphere faster than running out of oil.
What's the brown?
The brown is, I think, natural gas. So there's dispute about whether the peak is actually in 2000 or 2037 or 2010 or 2006, but the consensus seems to be it's roughly now. And what this means, it's very good news. It's the best news out of this whole thing, in my view. It means that the real price of energy is likely to start to finally go up. And there's all kinds of weird market forces that can tweak and push on that, and in my view are actually dangerous, because the thing that's going to drive more adaptation to the situation than anything else is basically, you know, scarcity of food. When things start to get a little bit constrained, that's when organisms adapt. This is kind of the Green Party view of it. It shows the caveman back in 1830, and then the peak, and then, you know, the crash, and we're back to being the caveman in, you know, 2150. Sometimes I think the problem with the sort of radical deep ecology green view is it's more attached to being right than knowing what to do about it. That we already have too many people on the planet to go backwards. There's sort of a vision of like, well, the whole thing collapses and we go back to pastoralism, involves, you know, the die-off of a large percentage of the population, which could be us. This is energy use. It's actually energy use per capita, and what's kind of what's got both total, the black line and the red line, is per person. And what's encouraging about it is that the per capita use actually leveled off from the oil shocks of the 70s. You know, I don't have a note on it, and I don't want to say. I think it's worldwide, but I don't know. It could be U.S. The point being, though, that we didn't really get very much price signal and a little bit of panic in the 70s, and it led to enough efficiency just from that little bit of shock to have a huge effect. This is a graph of CO2 in Canada. This was something I pulled off the web because it sort of showed the difference. The purple line is where they would have gone by themselves, gone before. The green line is where they were headed, and the blue line was with the mitigation efforts they were trying to make. You know, this shows the blue line not quite getting level. And so, you know, absent stuff like I've been talking about with Aprita, CO2 could be a huge, you know, the major problem, and most people think it is right now. I actually, at this point, am more frightened of overall resource consumption. You can see this graph looks about the same as the energy graphs. And it's got this horizontal line of 1.0, and it's sort of saying we're using more than one Earth worth of resources right now. There's a lot of ways to count that. The figure's thrown around that about 95% of our output is waste, but this includes tremendous amount of matter from mining, you know, tailings and all of this stuff. And we actually probably have enough metals mined right now that we should really stop it. There's a lot of things where there's enough stuff in circulation. What we haven't figured out now is how to get to closed loops. And the real problem is not how much mass we're moving around at this point. It's really certain key indicators and the collateral damage that we're doing either by what we're directly taking out of the biosphere or by the collateral destruction that we're causing in the course of taking what we want. And I would argue that it's really forests, fisheries, farmland, and fresh water, which are the sort of four key indicators that we should be focusing on rather than these footprint calculations that are in vogue, because the footprints tend to include the surface area of trees you need to sequester carbon. And if we actually do get a handle on energy, as Aprita suggests we could actually deal with that. Solar, wind, other things will deal with the energy. So if you take energy out of the situation and say, you know, what are we destroying fastest that will be irrecoverable? It's really the direct destruction of biodiversity that matters. It's destruction of forests. This is a diagram of fisheries that sort of peaked in the 70s. In many cases, we're causing the fisheries to collapse now. This is a map of farmland. Actually, it's showing how much nitrogen is being put onto surface area. And this is a map of amount of fresh water arable by surface area. These are the really key areas to focus on, in my view. And in some ways, what's sort of too bad is that the distraction with global warming is in some ways pulling us away from keeping the eye on the ball with this biodiversity issues. Biodiversity is really the measure, one of two measures of how well we do, in my view, making it through our lifetime. Biodiversity, the species of plants and animals that survive, that have the potential then to repopulate and spread back to redeployed world, what we lose, this is the neck of the hourglass. However, and this is just to say, those represent real limits to population in a way that I think many people are still not taking on board. If you look at population, this is the graph in the long-term view of population, just to sort of get it graphically. And this is still projected. It's showing it peaking at about 10. This is at a different time scale. We're actually at about 6.5. You know, we're in here somewhere. But the lowest one takes us to about 8.5 billion people. So in failing some sort of huge plague or something like that, we are at least pushing 9 billion people, and some of those just keep going. And what's particularly difficult with population is that the estimates of what's going on are pretty divergent right now. You have people saying, it's okay, we've got it under control, it's, you know, we're doing really well, and you have other people saying, you know, it really isn't, and it's still taking off. And I haven't been able to find a consensus that really seems credible that we know what's going on. The one thing we do seem to know is that the thing that limits it in much of the world is women gaining access to contraception secret from men, and then any level of education and empowerment of women. Those two things are what we know have effect on population. Whatever happens with population, it has to turn out to be a curve like this, or we crash. That at some point it has to level off and go towards a plateau. And this curve is very important because it's sort of a picture of our time. It describes population, but it also describes a sort of idea of what has to happen that I think we culturally really haven't taken on board yet. So the final one on that list is the economic realm. And in some cases, it's less important than the other realms I've just shown because it's not, in a sense, real. It's not material. It's theoretically under our control. and yet paradoxically it's the one thing that we seem to operate as if it's the most out of our control, as if it were God separate from us. And there's nothing that could ever be said to contradict the logic of how things are right now. And I am taking a lot of this from Bernard's inspiration. So this is just a list of some of the things for audiences that haven't just had the benefit of his talk, that that our current money system is really debt-based, and that it's really faith-based. That, you know, in we have in the money on in God we trust, it's really in money we trust. And it is a big confidence game. Somewhere in the middle 90s, possibly even at this point over 98% of the wealth is held by less than 2% of the population. And somewhere in the upper 90% of what we call trade is really speculative investment, as I understand it. I don't know if I'm right on that one. I'll get that in the questions. And we've seen whole regions of the world routinely go into crisis. And it looks, to me at least, as if it's not their fault, as if the system is designed such that periodically whole regions of the world, it's their turn to have trouble. And there are probably people making money on that. So this is an overall statement of the bad news. And it's really designed to focus on what we're up against, because I think most people don't really have it very clearly in mind what's at stake. It's not the state fate of the world or the earth that's at stake. The earth will do very well no matter what. It's recovered. It's just it doesn't recover in the time scale of human experience. And it also won't recreate the conditions for humans to have the opportunity that we have now. It has taken the whole life of the earth as one system of which we are part to get to the point where we have these fossil hydrocarbons, where we have everything teed up to have the opportunity. It's as if we're engaged in this kind of lunge to go somewhere, and we don't yet know where it is. If we blow it and we don't make it, we will essentially be thrown back to some probably pre-technological state and have no future to go anywhere else again. And we will face a huge die-off of the current population we have in the process. It will happen more or less within our lifetime, certainly our children's lifetime, certainly our grandchildren. What's at stake is on our watch. And the forces involved and the things to focus on, I maintain, are different than a lot of people focus on. There's these huge forces, and we really would do well to look at the big drivers and the big issues that we're wrestling with. This is, again, sort of a list of those six transitions from CO2 emission to net CO2 removal. We're really going to have to reverse global warming. We're that far into it. From fossil fuels to renewables, from destruction of nature to biodiversity preservation, from resource consumption to closed-loop cycles, from population growth to population stability, and from worsening disparity to greater equality. I hold that those six, at a very high level, are the six key kind of outcome indicators that we're wrestling with. Now, there's, you know, great detail in, you know, what it would take to do each of these, but basically we have to do all of these, not just within our lifetime, but probably within the next decade or so, if we're going to pull it off. We have to be making serious progress on these, and up to this point, we have not. So, you know, it's a pretty frightening situation. It currently seems kind of like one of those Chinese puzzles where every time you try and push in a peg, it pushes out on something else. And, you know, from the sort of UN global development model, it seems pretty intractable. So having given you a lot of bad news, I'm going to switch gears now and actually lay out what I think is a fairly radically optimistic view. Oh, sorry, I'm ahead of my own slides. So in terms of trying to understand the situation, hold that for a minute. One metaphor that's thrown around a lot to describe the global situation is cancer. It's a legitimate biological metaphor when you have a population just exploding. Another one might be bacteria or mold in a petri dish, where it will just, you know, consume food until it gets to the end of the food and the edge of the world, and then there's no more world left, and it's all over. The other biological metaphor that I can find that's at all optimistic would be embryonic development, where you have a period where an organism is going through very, very rapid change and growth and consuming resources like crazy. And if you think of it in terms of an egg, like a chicken embryo or a seed, it's this period where there are these resources that are being consumed and there's a lot of growth, but the growth is going somewhere. And if you think of the mantra of, you know, Western industrial technological civilization, the mantra would be growth, growth, growth. Why? Nobody can answer that question. It's as if we're sort of taking off to infinity, but nobody sees where or why or how we'd come out the other side of it. So it seems, if that's the metaphor for the whole world, that we're... what's implied is some higher order complexity in the whole planet, that the whole planet has to be seen in some sense as some single organism that's going somewhere. And we really are at a unique fold point where, until our lifetime, nature, at least in our culture, was by and large something with teeth and claws that could jump out of the dark and eat you. It was something much more powerful than us that we were at the mercy of. In a single lifetime, that has inverted to where nature is something that is fragile and in danger of destruction at our hands. And in my experience, the younger somebody is, the more likely they are to take this on board. When you go to little kids, they seem to just know this instinctively. When you go to somebody my grandparents' age, it's a crapshoot. They may really get it, and they may just not be able to conceive of it. And people my age are kind of somewhere in the middle. And in many ways, what's remarkable is not that we've been able to take this on board, or that we haven't taken on board, but that we have. Given the whole evolutionary history of humanity, to be able to make a change this big in one lifetime is huge. It's a tremendous adaptation. And at the same time, you know, we have the science and the technology that's empowered the science to be able to recognize and map and look at the family tree of life. And really, we need to make the breakthrough to seeing not just the human family, but all of this as our family tree, that this is us. All of this, the whole planet, all the life forms, all the humans, all the technology, it's all one organism. So if these trends that I'm describing were to be able to decelerate, change direction a little bit, curves that previously looked like log curves, like they're taking off to infinity, would turn out to be either S curves or bell curves. They would change shape. Oops, this is the one I was trying to substitute in. So the one on the far side there is a log curve. It just explodes. That's sort of the current Western industrial model of growth, like progress goes off to infinity. The middle one is kind of what we're recognizing about peak oil. It's got to, you know, come back down from where it was going. And the one on this side is kind of like population, but it's also in many ways the sort of key image for a lot of what we do. We need to sort of take the energy of what we've got in this acceleration, and we need to use it to go somewhere where we'd want to land. We need to go to some sort of stable place where we'd want to get to. And this S-curve implies, if it came out of a line that you could think of as nature, and this curve could be population, it could also be the rate of change, just how fast we're inventing novelty and changing things. It gets to a point where the curve is so steep that it feels terrifying. And I would suggest that that's where we are right now. We've all of a sudden gotten to this point where the acceleration of change has gone from something we were optimistic about even a few decades ago to something that's quite terrifying. And it's beginning to dawn on us that what looks like on the other side of it is more a crash than anything else, and that's becoming terrifying in a hurry. And yet, you can't go backwards, which is one of the other impulses, to say, well, let's just slow it down. What I'm suggesting is we have to use the momentum of that system to jump, sort of to escape to a higher order of complexity, which is what nature has done again and again when faced with crisis. So the point of inflection would be where the curve changes direction. It would be that point where we see nature differently. It would be the point about 2000 where our whole culture unified on one system of time and agreed this is a zero point. There are so many trends in our lifetime. Basically, all of the trends I've just outlined suggest that we're at this critical point, that the curve has to change directions when all of these trends all get critical at the same time. So this is a little rundown of what the S-curve, sort of the point of inflection metaphorically means. The point of inflection is a mathematical name for the point where a curve changes from concave one way to concave the other. So one of the things about this point is that at that point where the change is almost going vertical, those of us that are concerned with sustainability have become disturbed that nothing we're doing right now is sustainable. Well, this says it's actually appropriate that nothing's sustainable. Everything we have right now is so inefficient we wouldn't want to keep it around very long. So we're sort of crashing through this moment where we start to make stuff that's barely good enough. And we actually will start making stuff that's much better very fast, because we're still really so bad that we can make huge gains in very short periods of time. And only after you get a little further out there and you start getting to sufficient efficiency do you start realizing, oh, if I make something that lasts longer, I'll get more payback from that thing that I invested energy and resources in. So once you get to a high enough level of efficiency, you get interested in longevity. But we won't be there for a while. It won't be appropriate quite yet. I mean, a few of us are ahead of the curve, but for most of the culture, it's got to go through this lunge. This is also the moment, literally up until Y2K, it was as if nobody could see past the year 2000. It was this sort of like veil. And, you know, then we kind of crashed through it and then got distracted by 9/11, which, you know, the anthropologists say that when you're going to make a huge change, the last thing you do is the way the elders said, but more. You know, so we make this like last grab for making the enemy other humans. But really, the things that are threatening us at this point are not other humans. It's this whole system that we're all embedded together, and we're really all in it together. This point is also very much like the neck of the hourglass, or literally like a birth canal. It's the point that we have to squeeze through to get to this next phase. And it's chaotic, highly unstable, and highly dangerous. Like birth, there's no guarantee that you make it. So as we pass through this point, one measure of whether we make it will be preservation of biodiversity. The other measure will be whether we can achieve the climax technology fast enough. So in a sense, we still need probably the high-growth capitalist mode for a little while longer, only we need to apply it to building out sustainable technology very rapidly, and then we need to be decelerating out of that phase. So again, this is a sort of picture of the sort of the neck of the hourglass and the S-curve in one diagram, sort of suggesting that we came from this baseline of nature and we're trying to make the jump to this plateau that I'm calling meta-nature, and in between is, you know, what we regard so far as history and the Industrial Revolution. And there's probably a phase that's kind of like the mirror forward of what we've just experienced in the Industrial Revolution, only with a recognition that we're going somewhere. And so it would be a phase where we sort of unbuild the rat race and decelerate towards some place we'd actually want to end up. So if we want to really go deeper into this conceptual idea of this kind of potential plateau state in matter, in order to go there, what I'm going to do next is take you into a little diagram of chemistry. So this is something I made up shortly after the vision I was talking about before, about 25 years ago. This is all of the chemical elements. This shows the symmetry pattern very clearly. It's just those that have s and p orbitals. It's the eightfold symmetry of chemistry. So it doesn't have the metals or the inner transition metals. And then this is just the inner elements. And almost all of the action in life goes on using these puzzle pieces. This is where if you leave out the lithosphere, this is where all the action is. And what this is, it's a plot of charge, of electrical charge versus atomic charge versus mass or atomic number. And then the radius of each element is shown as the size of the sphere. So that the rest state of the atom is relatively the scale that is shown as a sphere here. And so the center of the spiral is hydrogen, which has one electron. Things coming up this way are what's called the noble gases. Their orbital shells are full, so they won't react with anything else, so they're gases. Things coming down this way are exactly half empty or half full. So they make very good building blocks for constructing structures with everything else. So carbon is the basis of life, and silicon is the basis of rock. And then silica and alumina and oxygen, that's much of rock is based on that. And carbon and life is mostly made up of carbon and hydrogen, nitrogen and oxygen. So you can see this little triangle in here, these four elements right at the core, are the smallest, most compact puzzle pieces. Sorry?
I was just going to encourage you to stay standing.
Oh, okay. Some people couldn't see as well if I do. So those are kind of the puzzle pieces of creation. And the reason that we have things, when you hear these chemical elements as words thrown around, this little diagram can help you to sort of think about what you're seeing. And the next thing to know is that the reason chemistry works is everything's trying to get to balance. So things on one side will tend to react with things on the other side to try and share electrons to behave like a noble gas. So sodium and chlorine, those two, will link to each other to make salt. So they share all their electrons together to get 8 electrons. One's got 7, one's got 1, they come together. So there's this really simple elegance to chemistry, if you can kind of grok it that way, that lets you see what's going on. For now, the main point I want to make out of this is just to sort of understand this relationship between hydrogen, carbon, and silicon. When you get to hydrogen, there's nowhere else to go. You're at the smallest, lightest element. There's, you know, when you hear people talking about the hydrogen economy, there's a reason. It's that there's no pieces left. It's not like we're going to have more progress and find some other way in matter to store energy. There's a reason why carbon is the basis of life and increasingly the basis of human technology. It's the smallest element that you can use to make complex structures. Silicon similarly works that way in a little different level. It's almost as if silicon is an octave of carbon. So this is, again, a kind of restatement of my big thesis of what's going on here, that we really have, you can look at all of industrial civilization, science, technology up to this point as kind of a lunge to accumulate sufficient knowledge and mastery of matter to be able to put the puzzle together in ways that approach the elegance of what nature has done. And that the potential to do this is built into matter the same way the potential for life to do it is built into matter. It's inherent in existence. And these solutions that we are now finding are not simply copies of nature. They are essentially instantiations of something that begins to approach the elegance of what nature did. And we have a long way to go, but what I'm pointing to is that there are this class of solutions that will also cohabit with nature harmoniously in a way that we haven't previously been able to do. And that it's not that progress in mind and investigation and knowledge would in some way stop, but the obsession with matter will be over. We will actually figure out the problem of how to live in matter harmoniously. We have to or die at this point. We will probably do it. And that will no longer be, you know, in a few hundred years, the prevailing problem for humanity. I don't know what will be. I'm sure we'll find more. This is another diagram I found that in a lot of ways gave me the confidence to make that statement. this is a completion of Leonardo's Vitruvian Man. And the reason that it's called a Vitruvian Man is Leonardo at the time was illustrating a book about Vitruvius that was 1,500 years before him. The recipe that he used to draw his diagram was 1,500 years old when he drew it. What I noticed, I had been playing with pure symmetry, pure geometry, and noticed that there are essentially three fundamental symmetries that could be described by the shapes triangle, square, and pentagram, or the numbers 3, 4, and 5, and that if the circle and square were there in his drawing, the other two systems should also be there. And I obsessed about this for months and wasn't able to find it, and one night at 3:45 a.m. it came to me and I wrote it down.
Uh-huh.
And each of the three systems is what's called the golden mean relationship to the radius of the circle. And then I had to put it aside for another 7 years before I finally figured out how high to place the cross piece. Because the radius of the circle to the side of the square is what's called the golden mean. And if you take half the square and the golden mean, it gives you the height of the arms. And when you do that, the systems of symmetry lock together on the central axis at the crown of the head, at the navel, and at the floor of the perineum. And you get all these different chakra systems out of it. You can pick which seven you want. And they mostly come out of the pentagonal symmetry system, which is the most often found in organic animal forms. The pentagonal system is sort of dynamic, and life forms often express it. But my point is that this diagram suggests, again, it's what gave me the confidence to go looking in this direction, that both nature and us are an expression of this puzzle that is built into the nature of existence. And the potential for us to find ways to live harmoniously on the planet are also built into that. And we had to sort of descend into history, you know, eat the apple and you know, sort of take the fall, to go through the process of getting the knowledge to do it, and we're now at that point. We can do it. So again, I said earlier that silicon is like an octave of carbon. Photovoltaics, in a sense, are like an octave of photosynthesis. Only now we're doing it in silicon instead of carbon. But when nature does photosynthesis, it's about 1% efficient. That's good enough for nature to construct all of life. Economists tell us that 10% efficient isn't good enough. It's an order of magnitude more energy than nature's getting, but it's a different approach. The approach with silicon, instead of recreating life all the time with leaves, will be to build things where once we build them, they're very, very stable and we could retire on them for 7 generations. If you can put silicon together in the right puzzle pattern and make it just absolutely stable, it will sit there, solid state, and deliver energy. And we could lose our obsession with energy. And once you have that, many other things become possible. So this is a little tour of the different forms of energy that we're using, and just pointing out that they're all solar. All of the renewable energy sources are solar. This is a little diagram of from a sort of entropy point of view, this is the spike, the orderedness of the light spectrum coming in, and this is the light spectrum of the heat going out from the planet. And it's the fact that we're bringing in something very ordered and dumping something very disordered that lets us live. And it's the same thing that nature's doing that we're doing with photovoltaics, with our solar. But wind is also being driven by that. And biomass is being driven by that. And biomass, we're just taking advantage of organic forms. But with biomass, when we look at what we've been doing with fuels over time, we've gradually been shifting the ratio of carbon to hydrogen in our fuels, from wood to peat to coal to oil to natural gas to hydrogen. When we get to hydrogen, there's nowhere else to go. We're at the smallest, lightest element that we can use for transport. This is another indicator that we're at the end of this sequence, that we finally arrived at a point where there really isn't anywhere else to go. This is a diagram of that same idea showing solids and gases. One of the first people to describe this, to be close enough to the time where you could see the train wreck coming, or what looked like the train wreck, and yet have access to enough of the sort of fruits of science and technology was Bucky Fuller, who talked about humanity's option for success. The idea that we really can figure out how to make it work for all of humanity and all of nature. And one of the things that he's known for, along more known for than his views on the planet, is his views on geometry. And having seen through to that possibility of how pure geometry can work, he created these geodesic spheres, which allowed chemists to see that it was possible that you could put carbon together that way. And so, again, it was this pure theoretical insight that led to the actual practical breakthrough. And you can make not just spheres, but tubes. And when you do that out of carbon, those structures, I would bet, are going to be as strong as anything it's possible to make. Right now, we're beginning to make carbon fibers, which are just like little bead chains of single carbons. When you start making tubes out of it, it's another degree stronger. So all of this suggests this idea of industrial ecology, which was sort of the earliest form of it, the idea that within human cycles of materials flows and energy flows, they would begin to be like nature's, that we would begin to make flows where the food for one thing is the output of something else, and everything and the energy is conserved and optimized. This idea has been floating around for a while. Also, we've had people like John Todd, who popularized the idea that we could simply arrange natural systems in the right configuration, and they would do what they already do, but they would integrate into our systems. Janine Benyus has taken this even farther in talking about the idea of directly copying from nature and being inspired by structures in nature and using these as the basis of human technology. I think a tremendous amount of that will happen. What I'm pointing to is the possibility that it's not, while the copying was legitimate, there is something going on that's not just copying. This is a little thing describing the Aprita technology that Danny talked about and that I've been talking about. And when we get to this technology, in the context of what I've just been describing, this is essentially the analog of the carbon cycle for human energy technology. It represents finally figuring out how to cycle all of those simple elements around in a closed cycle where everything ends up back where it wants to be. It does what nature's been able to do. It pulls the hydrogen off that we want for energy and manages to take all the nutrients back to the plants. So it represents a way of us integrating into the carbon cycle in a coherent way. And when people see it and they go, well, where's the downside? You know, where's the shadow? Why, you know, where's the problem? It's human technology. There must be a problem somewhere. The point is we're finally at this point where we're crashing through or just glimpsing these technologies that start to be treating matter as coherently as nature does. And it's not that nature like instantly got there. It took billions of years of experiment. You know, we've only screwed up for a few thousand years. We're doing pretty well. So, but what we're not yet recognizing is that we would be going somewhere. We still can't sort of see the forest for the trees.
Jim, what's that Haber-Bosch process?
I'll just go through this again for anybody who didn't get it. Haber-Bosch is a process where you take hydrogen and you get ammonia out of the air. So you use hydrogen to crack nitrogen. And so you end up with ammonia. And
where is the ammonia coming from? What's the chemical structure of ammonia?
NH4. So you're actually using the hydrogen, and actually what you get out of this is carbon monoxide, which you can take with the hydrogen and you can make a biodiesel, actually a Fischer-Tropsch diesel. So you don't actually just have to make hydrogen, which is hard to manage and it's a gas and it's expensive.
That's what I was looking for, the biodiesel. I didn't see it anywhere.
The biodiesel would be sort of here, where you're taking, if you actually added into this, you take the other output of this and this hydrogen, and you put it together and you make it's actually a more high-energy diesel than biodiesel. Biodiesel is made from food crops. This is made from gases. So just conceptually, what this represents is a closed loop where we're returning all of the nutrients back to the soil in a way that actually makes the soil more fertile than what we started with, and also puts the carbon and creates habitat for all the biological symbiote organisms that we need. This is sort of the last, I know there's a lot of big ideas in here, this is the last one I'm going to throw at you, and then we'll kind of come to a resting point. This is a sort of metaphoric idea about economics and nature, where we think of the time value of money as very inevitable. And one way of justifying that would be to point at a biological metaphor and say that if you have a barren field, a burned field or a former piece of farmland, and you let it sit there, over time, more plants will grow up that will deploy more leaf surface. And each kind of plant that comes into that burned field that's able to put more leaf surface will be able to capture more sunlight in a period of time. So you could sort of see a metaphor for a human time value of money where the more plant technology that you're able to deploy in that field, the more capital you have, plant capital, the more sunlight you can harvest in a given period of time. And you have a sort of time value of sunlight, which justifies a growth-based model of economics. The more time you have there and the more capital you have, the more sunlight you can capture, and it grows, and it sort of looks like what we're doing. And this continues as you go through different stages of succession and you put more and more surface area of leaf out until you eventually get to a climax forest. And at that point, you can't do that anymore. You've deployed as much leaf surface area as you can for the available water and nutrients in the soil, and that's what it'll support. And now you're at a different kind of model. You're at some sort of long-term sustainable cooperative model. Whereas competition was highly favored during that first phase, cooperation is highly favored in the next phase. And somehow nature manages to get from one phase to the other smoothly. And so we're in an economic state where we're really in a succession-based kind of economics. Our economics looks a lot like what nature's doing as it grows up in a burned field. And somehow, we have to use that process to grow up a sustainable kind of technology that will then also transition to a stable economic system. So this is kind of just a summary of some of the things I've gone over.
Technology plus cooperation.
It's a whole new attitude towards both.
Yeah, the technology alone doesn't do it.
The reason I'm focusing on technology so much in this is because there are many, many people talking about this point of transformation from all kinds of spiritual, psychological, social dimensions. We all know lots and lots of them. And yet we live in a world where most people insist that it's the material situation and science and economics, and these are the things that matter. And so what I'm trying to do in the argument that I just gave is to present something that's very much grounded in chemistry and physics and maybe a little bit in economics that sort of goes to those hard arguments and says these are very strong arguments why this is what's going on. And these other things that lots of other people are going to fill in will make sense of that.
But you are dealing in economics. You've talked about 98% of the wealth held by 2% of the people and
well,
things like that.
Yeah, and I think that this is the final list that I have of sort of the six transformations that we need to make. Mm-hmm. And I actually suspect that the key leverage point to making the first five is the sixth. That what Bernard's pointing at is the leverage point on the whole system. The thing that keeps us trapped in doing it the old way is game rules. You know, what people call the laws of economics, I like to call game rules. Because, you know, when they're the laws, it's like physics. You know, it can only be this way.
That's ethos plus nomos.
So this is sort of the final statement I have on the whole thing, and this is really what I'm trying to get to, is that in order to make this transformation, I think we really, what I'm trying to do is to point to a way of framing the world that both validates everything that has happened up to this point and explains in the light of this larger perspective how and why we would need to shift what we're doing to go in a new direction. And it's not a U-turn. For most players, it's just, you know, just a little shift. But we're at a point in the curve where a little bit of change in direction will take it an entirely different landing. And I think also by being able to explain it in a way that actually does validate everybody, that from this perspective, the only way we could do what we're doing, it's sort of literally, this was a set of meditation that started with Ram Dass's guru's statement that everything's perfect. You know, whereupon Ram Dass recounted the, you know, burning women in napalm and Vietnam and all these things. And I was sort of thinking about this and having the same reaction from my personal view of lack of sustainability in the world. And I said, well, wait a minute. What if the spiritual teachers who say that everything is perfect were right? How could I try and imagine a story about the world where they would be correct and the critique that all of us see would be correct? And in fact, many of the people who we perceive as being on the other side would be correct. Only all of us would have to do something different than what we thought. Now, there's an even deeper version of that that's a little scarier, which I'm also going to recount. And this would not go in the first book. And this part goes this way. If you look at virtually all cultures, the idea of a sort of personal transformation where somebody has to undergo a process of psycho-spiritual death and rebirth is pretty universal. The born-again Christians aren't the only ones with a kind of born-again experience. At the same time, if you look across the world right now, I'm not sure how universal it is or whether it's really something coming from the Christian world and invading others, but there certainly is a very powerful archetypal story that seems to map that death and rebirth process to the whole world. And there are people that are so attached, so we get, you know, these are places where I've been able to find some evidence of it. And again, I don't know which of these are derivative and which are really there. This one, we know it's there. But it's also there in this one.
All the ones you showed are real.
Okay, well, and this is one that's even newer, Teilhard's. And, you know, if we think about those of us that subscribe to this one, some idea of emergent global consciousness, even those of us that subscribe to this view don't experience the world that way. You know, I still experience myself as a skin-encapsulated ego, even if I'm sympathetic to this idea of global consciousness. And even Marx's idea, if you strip out all of the fighting about it, sounds more like a mystic visionary in this one little piece of, you know, from each according to his ability to each according to his need. That could almost be a kind of Christian statement. Mm-hmm. So, again, taking that same perspective that I just recounted before and trying to apply it to this situation where it seems in the world every time we come up on a fork and one path would lead to a nice, orderly, stable transformation to a world we'd want and the other path goes towards crisis, we seem to go, crisis, you know, and it's as if we're intending to go there. So it almost seems to me that there may be something built into the process of psyche and organisms that we, in order to have this birth experience, we need to actually have a sort of forging event, kind of like biological birth, that pushes you through this crisis. And if I actually think about what could happen that would be sufficient to fulfill this, you know, that would be experienced as the end of the world, but would simultaneously actually clear away the obstacles to doing all these things we need to do rather suddenly, the only thing that I'm able to imagine is some sort of economic trauma. Because most people don't live in the material world. They live in a symbolist world of money. This world is so much more real to us than the material world that if it was challenged or thrown upside down, it would be the end of the world. It would fulfill the prophecy. And yet it would also potentially fulfill the prophecy if we were able to somehow have a safety net. If we understood that as an opportunity and were in some way prepared for that as a necessary point where the really big transformation could actually happen. So that concludes the whole story and maybe lands back where you were asking about. So I'm going to stop the slides there. We have a few minutes left in this session, and this was also intentionally meant to be sort of a lead up to Bernard's session following this. So...
I have a question. So I'm curious about the notion of going from one plateau to another, and you know, if we were to zoom back on that, to get further back perspective, might the shape of that turn into something different? You know, is the notion that the rate of change is constantly increasing a reality, or is it something that's a reality for a short period of time, or is it a longer ongoing kind of thing? And how would we know?
Well, just mathematically, if you're just talking about shapes of curves, if you zoom back, it goes from what's being called an S-curve to what's called a square wave, or more like what they talk about in physics is a quantum leap. That in the time scales, of all of the rest of biological evolution, our existence, you know, doesn't even show up, and it would just be like kind of a jump. These are all metaphors, and they're useful, and getting too tightly attached to them is also, you know, a trap.
You talked about an economic collapse as being the kind of death and rebirth. And earlier on, you talked about, if we abandon some of our technology, and we're going to see a sharp decrease in food production and a loss of a significant portion of the population. It seemed to me it was like a pretty easy out to just have a little economic problem as opposed to sort of broader biological problems. Have you thought much about presuming that, we're going to have this decline, rebuilding, about how far down we ought to drop and are going to drop and what our options are for controlling how far down we drop during that rebirth?
Yeah, I'm not actually... Well,
maybe I'm asking not only you that question, but maybe there's someone in the room who has thought deeply about it.
Yeah, and I would say for myself, and I'm sure there are people who have thought about it, that I'm trying not to be of the sort of population crash school of this is the only way we can make it. I'm sort of more following Bucky's lineage that says there actually are ways for the whole population to pull it off, and that... what is easy to call a collapse in shorthand has to be some sort of transformation. That there are characteristics of the system we have as it is right now that if they don't change, we'll crash the thing really seriously. And there are characteristics of it, if we lose them too much, the system will crash. And I don't know how we thread that needle.
So we might have a Venezuela-style event, that worldwide Venezuela event, where most of the people
Argentina.
Yeah, in many ways, what I'm able to talk about here is, in some ways, so far back the lens that it sort of says things about the characteristic of the whole system and the whole system further out. What happens very near term to get us to that potential? I'm less able to say with any certainty.
can you, in your thinking about this, can you imagine a scenario that doesn't have, let's say, an economic crash? Is there like, you know, and I like very much, I really like the whole picture. Thank you, it's really excellent. But can you, is there like, can you imagine something that we might take on or...
Well, yeah, I mean, this goes into the next session with Bernard, that from the technological point of view, I can lay out all kinds of optimistic scenarios. One of them is a Prieto. You know, it, to me, is one of the things that makes it possible for me to not think about global warming and energy as the most serious problems, which makes me now focus on biodiversity loss comes to the top of my list. Whereas most people, even in the NGO world environment, are still focused on global warming because nobody sees what to do about it yet. But in terms of how to make a smooth transition, I've known Bernard for I don't know how many years, and the only optimistic scenario I've been able to come up with is one where a commodity-backed trade credit that has a demurrage built into it is seen by corporations as the lifeboat in the face of currency instability. And so fiat money goes into crisis, corporations are able to escape to a commodity-backed credit. The commodity-backed credit has a demurrage which pushes them into long-term thinking. Long-term thinking builds in externalities because they now count, because you're taking a long-term view. Once the major corporate trade players are willing to see things that way, the WTO is now willing to take things on board. You actually get to global trade rules that internalize environment and social costs, and the economic system becomes adaptive, rapidly deploys capital to long-term technologies because they're now in a long-term view, and you pull it off. I don't know, you know, in that optimistic view, it still has built into it probably at least a moment or moments of what, as you traverse them, feel like crisis. The difference between crash and transformation is having that safety net in place, in my view.
Just real quick, Paul, could a group of inspired leaders emerging at the same time do this?
Mm-hmm. I tend to take much more the systems point of view. I tend to take the view that game rules have far more effect than individual decision. And one of the huge problems with sustainability right now is that we think we're going to do it out of some sort of moral decisions of individuals, when in fact individuals and leaders are prohibited from making those decisions by the game rules. Jonathan, and then here.
The way that I've thought about this is what you described just there, it seems to be like a, for lack of a better word, an above. And I really believe that, you know, when you talk about the individuals, we, quote-unquote, in the local and the below are going to have to adopt what I call the flat tire moment, which is what happens when you get a flat tire, which you have to try to stop and fix it. And I'm thinking that in order for us to have or to get through this shift point with as much joy and creativity and fun as possibly can have is to now take on individually get them as much sustainability at a local level as we can. In other words, to create a flat tire moment where I would literally have to give up certain things that I take for granted now until such times they can be provided. For example, one of those might be air travel. Who knows how much of the internet and electricity and so on is based on huge resources coming through, such as natural gas and oil. But the shift to the wind-driven that you're talking about is not going to... It's going to take place over time. Mm-hmm. So the more that we human beings impose on ourselves the flat tire moment, I think the easier it is it will become to get through that shift point in time. It's just the theory that I've been thinking about when it comes to meet what you're talking about. We talked about the meta view you just talked about, which was a wonderful cycle. It really needs to possibly be met with individual action.
I want to clarify something and then go here. In many ways, when I point to this sort of... likelihood or suspicion that the system has to go through some sort of point of crisis, it comes much more from my experience with Stan Grof and a lot of sort of psycho-spiritual work, where if I look around the world right now, and particularly the United States, but any rich country, and really not just the rich countries, everywhere, it seems to me that quite plausibly a huge part of being able to go where we need to is a real transformation of consciousness attitude that can only, you know, you call it the flat tire moment. It's this sort of whole shit experience. And not like, oh, these other bad people over there are the enemy and they're going to get me. But like, oh shit, it's one planet, we're all in it together, we just fucked up. And maybe even a feeling like it's irrecoverable. Like we may actually need to traverse some sort of shared experience of crisis as a sort of psychologically unifying, galvanizing and transforming psychological event before we can implement the technologies and game rules that we would need to for it to work. And it may be that in order to sort of snap us out of some of the patterns that we're all embedded in, that the system has to do that. I don't know. It seems plausible.
That's really my big question as an evolution biologist, and it's confused me for some time now. When you see the pattern, you see the trajectory. I became a pastist in order to become a futurist. You wonder, why is it that our species, which has this distinction of this big brain that can conceptualize and invent a linear time frame that permits us to learn from the past and see into the future, to make scenarios and stuff like that. And I say, why is it that we haven't done this yet? Why is it that we haven't seen this and made this easy on ourselves? Because the choice is you make it easy on us or you make it hard on us by waiting until the crisis overwhelms us. And as I think I said when I spoke, that the older I get, you know, the more time that has passed, the more I think, dang, are we going to have to do this like other species, where it takes an extinction to make a blossoming of new species? Like, there's something wrong with this picture. We're human. Right. We're supposed to be able to forestall the crisis. Well, many individuals have figured it out. We do know. You've told us about the technologies that are possible. We know the creativity isn't lacking. We know that we're stuck by the game rules. And we know that we could be creating sustainable communities, as you're talking about. So what is our maximum leverage for getting the most number of people with the power to change the rules, to get that the rules can be changed, should be changed, and that we'll all be better off for it? And I don't know whether we have to raise questions of what is power and its payoffs, and how do we get at that? Because those guys I mentioned, the Germans, saying are benefiting from this but won't admit it, that they want the world the way it is, but they can't admit that publicly. What could you do with those people to get them to see the advantages of the kind of power we want, the power to live well together, and get that to erode into their power over others or whatever it is that makes them stuck in the rigidity?
The specific path I'm suggesting in this particular lens is partly just to describe a scenario that looks likely, and as much as a long shot, also has this weird inevitability. You know, it looks on the one hand like you add all this stuff up, it looks like the system's meant to go there.
We can show them they can do better business by going this route. There's enough evidence of that already, but I don't think that's enough.
Well, it very well also may be that, you know, it's funny, you say, do we have to do it like other species? Well, you know, if it's all really one system, it may be hardwired into the thing that this is how one does it. It also may be that what Jonathan's talking about...
But we're the ones who have given up that hardwiring in our explosive brain. All other species do know how to conduct themselves, and we have to figure it out ourselves. That's the trade-off for the freedom, was the loss of the inbuilt rules. But then what we did instead was make up our own rigid rules, which we don't have to keep.
That's great.
I'm concerned about one aspect of your talk that I just want to feed back to
Thank
you
and
see how you respond. You said, we don't get a second chance. If we burn up all our fossil fuels this first time, we won't be able to do this. We won't be able to relaunch. We'll be stuck as cave people forever. And I think, first of all, that's false, because I think that the new technologies will be low energy enough so that with the scraps that are left around, we'll have no, we will in fact build out a climax technology.
Fair enough.
And that, in fact it's inevitable. And that if you say, instead of, we're about, you know, we're in this terrible, fearful condition where something might happen which is irretrievable and the chance is lost forever to have a decent lifetime for future generations, and instead say, it's inevitable that future generations are going to work this out, which I believe it is, and how much it hurts along the way is up for negotiation. I think it's a more positive view, and one which also says to people, hey, little things count too.
Okay.
In other words, you can go off and take the flat tire idea and say, hey, I'm going to start living my life in a new way, and I'm going to be an example of what this future thing looks like. And when people get around to noticing that this is necessary, there'll be all these examples in place, and that's good. And then you can have the Bernards who are changing the whole system and making it possible for some of the big players to change. But I think we need a world in which all of those things make sense, because I think they're all needed.
It's a good point. Here's the point I was trying to make, and maybe I didn't say it well enough. If we continued to consume resources, you know, to destroy unique biological resources at the rate we are, for even another couple decades, without beginning to make changes very soon, the current estimates that I've seen from a group of biologists is that in 30-35 years we could destroy half of biodiversity. That's the most severe but credible estimate I've seen. I think very few people are taking that on board. And if we that severely damage the biosphere with the sort of momentum of the system we have, without taking the system off in another direction, and we consumed most of the low-hanging fruit in terms of the fossil reserves, and we ended up with the population continuing to grow, unless there were a plague that took out the population, the violent anarchy that would ensue when the existing system using fossil fuels came to sort of the end of the line, and or the climate change that it caused by taking it in the direction it's going. There are a lot of scenarios where population versus biodiversity versus available surface area, arable land, water, cause a crash and a collapse into violent anarchy that I think is legitimately true, and I am not convinced that a human population coming out of that violent anarchy with the absence of those fossil fuel reserves would be able to get back to the position we're in right now. I actually do take the radical point of view that the whole Earth is kind of like one egg or one organism or one seed, and that this seed has a sort of natural growth pattern, and that the whole of the momentum of industrial civilization is that embryonic development, and that either it fulfills that trajectory or it's stillborn. And I don't know exactly what stillborn looks like, but I am standing for the position that that's what's at stake.
I think this system is way more open to different possibilities than the development of an embryo is, and that it's not like that. That something, you know, things way more terrible than anything we could do in the next few generations have happened to the Earth in the past, where you've seen the extinction of 90-something high percentage of all the genuses, much less all the species. I mean, that's a really clean
right.
sweep, and yet we bounce back in a few hundred million years.
I'm not. But it. Let me just finish this, and then we'll go to you. But it did. Your second after here. It did, however, take. As far as we can tell, we're about halfway through the natural life of the sun. It's taken pretty much all of the evolutionary life of this planet to lay down the fossil fuel reserves. The kind of bifurcation point you're talking about, I can't be sure is wrong. So we could have very interesting discussions about it, and I will agree to advocate for the poll I'm talking about, but I'm not sure that you're incorrect. I'm just going to take this particular view on it. I do hear what you're saying, though, about trying to put it in a little more positive spin, but I also really think that a lot of people are not taking on board just how severe the challenge is right now, that you know, really what we're up against. Over here next.
Given what Gibbs just said, I was wondering, I thought maybe it was an opportunity to maybe reposition your statement just a little bit. I wondered if you might be willing to do it, which is, I think what you were referring to when you were talking, I understand you were talking in a broader sense, but
right.
but given his Gibbs argument, that at least I think you're talking about the thrust of Homo sapiens.
Yeah,
I that there's a lot of collateral damage we're talking about the Earth as well. But I think there's no doubt that the thrust of Homo sapiens is such.
I think he's talking Homo sapiens too. I mean, I'm as Elizabeth would agree. You know, the chances of Earth regenerating another flush of diverse biodiversity in a few hundred million years,
yeah.
It'll do it. You know, it's not the Earth. But yeah, and I'm. This is a really interesting conversation that I think we'll have to continue. We're at the end of the time for the session. We've got if two more people can be brief, and maybe I won't answer them, and then it's Bernard's floor. So.
No, then there's a break.
We need a break.
Yeah.
There's a half. We can't.
There's a half
break.
So, just to go ahead. Just from my work with people diagnosed with terminal illness, which mm-hmm. we can consider as what we've been talking about today, what I feel I've seen is that the dying process has an innate lawfulness in it, which I think you're trying to map out. And what I've seen is that thinks it's in control in the human life is exactly what has to die, what has to let go and has to surrender. There has to be reached, the person has to come to a place of acceptance. And that letting go will happen. Sometimes people reach that point of acceptance days, weeks, months before they die and transform and live out some of the transformation. Sometimes that ultimate letting go doesn't happen until a minute before they die, but it has to be reached because that's what death is about.
Mm-hmm.
Is letting go, is that which was in control, losing control. And so I feel in a little way we're trying to talk about how can we invent ourselves through this process. I mean, we can try that, but I think we're going to reach a point where it is beyond our trying, and we will have to, transformation is about total change, and I feel like, in a way, we haven't quite gotten to that in this discussion, that totalness of the change that will happen. And that dying has its lawfulness. I trust what you're saying. That's where I'm at, that this process we're going through is one of life. Life isn't the opposite of death. Life encompasses death, and there's death and rebirth, and death and rebirth, and death and rebirth, and life spans
that those
endless cycles of the dance of life and rebirth.
Thank you.
What I'm feeling in the room is the focus on the death experience, which is classic in our culture. You know, it's like tragedy, cars, pick up what sells in the newspapers, all of that sort of thing. And there's a fascination with it, which is important. But there's something that you've left out, which I missed. I was waiting for that slide. Is here you have the embryo, and then there's a breaking through of the embryo, this egg, to something else on the other side, and that's a letting go.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me feels like. The potential that's out there on the other side, and it's why I so am excited about Bernard's work, the potential of, I think we've become so misguided in our culture, in our fixation on money and that and the whole economic system. And in that being misguided, that status going on a particular course. And if we're just trying to shift over and get over here, everything in the economic system as we know it now is propelling us in that direction. And I know that you were trying to set up for the session with Bernard. Maybe it wasn't quite enough set up to really anchor in on that whole other piece of the potential of what something might look like, what our world could look like, what are the murals of peace.
Well, let me try a different metaphor to close on that actually came up in another conversation about this. Where if you're going to take this little S-curve diagram as and use a biological metaphor with it, and if you're going to pick the history up to this point as sort of metaphorical for embryonic development, and if the current moment, you know, whether it's our lifetime or the year 2000 or whatever, some hypothesized point of crisis, as essentially a metaphor of not just death, but also of birth. And then the phase coming out of that, the metaphor of that would be sort of early childhood development headed towards adulthood. So technology coming out of that point would still be coming with the same momentum that it had right before that point, but that would essentially be the point of a certain kind of self-awareness, that from that point forward, the system would be increasingly self-aware of where it was going, and that there was some sort of state of sort of adulthood of technology that the thing we're trying to grow towards, of maturity, and that it would still be immature for very rapid growth. The young child is growing very, very fast right after birth still. The growth doesn't stop with birth. But from birth forward, the growth is categorically different and is categorically more self-aware and has some sense of growing towards a sort of stable goal. And that also, if you go to some of Stan Grof's work, the experience of going towards birth comes necessarily, or at least psychospiritual death, with this full fear of death. So it's almost like if you look into
and
these
the
sort
of death.
Well,
real death.
The real possibility of death, a real fear of death, but also a sort of projected fear of death. So that the archetypes of all of these things are wrapped up together, and yet it's the sort of forging in that, in the compression of that process that's necessary to get to the next phase. And so what I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows, and I think we, in some ways, are a little off track from the metaphor I was trying to suggest, is whether we traverse that and most of the human population materially survives that, but cultural institutions we're very attached to don't, whether huge numbers of individual people don't, and there's some sort of horrendous calamity, and we come through that whole process and get out the other side of it. And that's how it works. I don't know. Nobody knows. I'm simply trying to suggest an overall map of the whole process that's kind of multivalent and has a lot of different layers of metaphor and meaning that are kind of seem to be co-aligned. And in some ways point to a more optimistic curve of what's on the other side of that. But I, I don't know what we go through.
Let me say one thing that I hear everybody talking about, the emergence of the feminine, and we're talking about a birth process here. As a woman who's given birth, when you give birth consciously, the experience is very, very intense, and there comes a point where you let go. Because whatever is coursing this process, your body knows how to give birth. Your mind doesn't, but your body does. And it's so powerful, and it overtakes you, and it delivers you or doesn't. You could die in the process. And that's literally a part of the experience, that you open up to that too. And a woman, when she gives birth, opens herself so incredibly. And this baby comes, and when she sees this baby and when she has this baby, one of the experiences that a mother has is she doesn't know who this is. She may have been in communion all through from the conception to the birth. When that baby actually arrives, it's in form in a way that she could not imagine. Okay, so there's this moment, and yet there's this complete bonding, this complete, you know, there's just a nature to nurture it and to pull it in and to take care of it and protect it and know that it is of their own. But at the same time, it is a complete mystery who this person is. And when it's come into form, even when it's been felt and known in the womb, when it comes into form, there's something else that's there that wasn't there before, because it's coming into a very specific, it comes into something specific. And so more specific than could have been experienced before. Even though it's a familiar specific in that there's a head and arms and legs and toes and fingers, but there's something else. So I think that in what we're talking about here, you did a beautiful job of talking about the nature of this process, you know, in terms of the whole evolution of this earth and this process and this moment that we are in. And everybody's talking about the emergence of the feminine, and yet there's something so very clean and clear in just the experience of a woman having a baby. That's what we're talking about. And that's that mystery, that piece that's in there, is the piece that, in a sense, when you give birth, you're out of control. You have no control. And I think as human beings, we all are trying so much to understand so we can somehow or other control this process.
Or crisis is a birth.
Yeah. Birth is bigger than anything we can think.
So I have a question. We're now about 15 minutes before the next session. Do we really want to take a break? Because we could continue the conversation right through. I think we should have a break.
Lovely.
Thanks for that.
Great job.